The Washington, D.C. Air Defense Identification Zone is now permanent. Great. Where do we go from here? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest today is Andy Cibula, who is AOPA's Executive Vice President of Government Affairs. Andy has been kind of the point person in relating the fight of AOPA against the Washington, D.C. Air Defense Identification Zone in terms of our contact with the process as pilots and members of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. And the disappointing word came down last week that the so-called temporary measure is now permanent, and by letting it just sit and sit for years and not really go through the normal process, this has kind of allowed the FAA to circumvent normal due process. Andy, thanks for agreeing to come on and talk about this. I know it's been a frustration for you.
Yeah, there's no doubt it has been a frustration. And I want to kind of correct something that you said.
Okay.
While the FAA was the implementer of the ADIS, I have strong reason to believe that if the FAA were the sole entity in charge, it probably either wouldn't exist or may not exist like we're seeing it as this final rule, because there are an awful lot of security agencies in Washington, D.C. that really were pushing for this. The Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Defense, and then, of course, there's a lot of various organizations within both of those entities that have various responsibility when it comes to Homeland Security. But they were the ones that really pushed for it, and the FAA kind of found itself in a position of being the implementer of the desires of the security community.
Well, a lot of the agencies in the security community had parochial interests in keeping this thing in place. Just as much the FAA, if anything, I would think, being charged with smooth operation of air traffic, would have wanted this thing to go away, maybe not quite as much as we would, but obviously I would think the bias within the FAA would have been to make it go away.
Yeah, and you know, what happened is, for 18 months after 9/11, there were no additional restrictions in the Washington, D.C. area other than the 15-mile area that was really centered on the Washington Monument. That was kind of the, if you will, the heart of Washington, D.C., and there were very, initially it was an actual no-fly zone, and then there got to be some operations permitted there, although even today they have very significant restrictions on them. And I think that most pilots can, well, they may not agree with them, may not like them, they can kind of understand those. But the ADIS, that is, as it became known, was implemented right before the United States entered into the conflict with Iraq. And there was one in Washington, D.C., and there was one in New York City. And I happened to be on the conference call in February of 2003 that established those. And when they were established, they were deemed to be temporary. The one in New York went away after Bush announced that hostilities had ended officially. But the one in Washington, D.C. didn't. And the frustrating thing was, you know, we asked, well, what about the one in Washington, D.C.? Really didn't get much of an answer. And after we had asked the question a couple times, we realized that we had to turn our simple questioning into something far more significant, which was an advocacy effort to push the Department of Homeland Security and some of the other security agencies to change this NOTAM, which is, of course, how the ADIS was initially implemented.
All right. Now, explain to our listeners a little bit, because I know you have a better handle on this than I do. What should have been the normal process if this was designed from the onset to be a permanent situation?
Well, what you would have is you would have a notice of proposed rulemaking. So an agency comes up with a proposal saying, we want to implement these particular restrictions around Washington, D.C. Let's say that was the proposal. They would put that out for notice. People could comment on it that were interested in the topic. The comment period would close. There would be an analysis of the comment, and then there would be a decision made about the policy implications, the cost-benefit implications, and then a decision would be made as to whether a final rule is going to be issued, whether it would look like what was actually proposed, whether it would be significantly different, or maybe they'd drop it altogether. in the case of the Washington DC 8 is what you had was several years after the NOTAM was issued, the FAA put out a proposal to make it permanent. 22,000 pilots commented, many of those from places far from Washington, D.C., but having the concern that if it happens in D.C., it can happen in my Class B airspace. And so there was a tremendous amount of opposition. But the reality is that those comments, as important as they are to us as pilots, really didn't sway the security establishment in Washington, D.C., other than some changes that we've seen, a slight reduction of the ATIS, a simplification of the shape of the ATIS, so it doesn't look like, as we call it, it knocked the ears off of Mickey Mouse. So now it's
right.
Just a circle, and it no longer has the other two kind of outcroppings, if you will.
All right. Now, you are headquartered in Frederick, Maryland, you know, fairly close to that situation, way closer to it on an everyday basis than most of the pilots who will be listening to this podcast. How onerous is this? What kind of changes does it really make in your life? I know AOPA did a study, funded a study in 2005 that suggested that something like $43 million a year in revenue was being lost in the local economies of 10 of the 13 affected airports. But on a day-to-day anecdotal basis, how big a pain in the butt is this thing?
Well, the problem comes is that, of course, in the general aviation pilot community, pilots, unless they, you know, are in Class B airspace, are really used to being able, VFR pilots, are used to being able to go out and take off without having to, if they don't want to, talk to an air traffic controller. They don't have to. They can squawk the standard 1200 squawk code. In the case of the ATIS, of course, you have to file a flight plan. In addition to filing a flight plan, you then have to be in touch with air traffic. And, of course, air traffic then has to give you a specially designated squawk code. So all of those add to the workload on the FAA air traffic control system. And, of course, they weren't initially prepared to handle it. They've done a little better job in handling that. But it still sets up a pretty significant impediment. But underlying all of that is the fact is if you make just a small procedural misstep, then you end up with a violation. You could get your certificate pulled, suspended, and of course, if you're in the business of actually trying to work in the aviation community, you know, you have some very significant concerns about it. Not that other pilots don't have concerns, but if you're looking to make a living, it's even worse. So there has been a lot of concern and anguish about that very issue, that you get these, you know, what are really inadvertent infractions of the rules, and you end up, you know, with a 30-day suspension, and of course that going into your record.
Right, and that equates to a 30-day layoff if you're a CFI.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Well, when we come back from the break, Andy, I want to talk about where we go from here, because at the end of the AOPA's press release, you mentioned that you know, circumstances evolve and rules can change, even though this is called a permanent rule. Let's talk about where we go from here.
Look forward to it.
My guest is Andy Cibula, AOPA Executive VP of Government Affairs. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Okay. Right up front, let me say that Garmin does not give tax advice. We have lawyers who cringe at the very thought of suggesting there might be tax advantages to buying a new Garmin avionics system this year.
Did he say tax advantages?
Could that be construed as tax advice, either express or implied?
Yeah, like I said, lawyers. So I guess I won't be telling you that this year Congress is offering special bonus depreciation up to 50% in year one for qualified business equipment placed in service during 2008. Business equipment like, say, a new Garmin avionics stack. But you didn't hear that from me, right?
What did he just say?
Okay, better check with your tax consultant for guidance and your Garmin dealer for the installation. Garmin. Follow the leader.
See your tax advisor for guidance.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. Paul Plack here with Andy Cibula, AOPA's Executive VP of Government Affairs. We're talking about the Washington, D.C. aid is, which started out as a temporary measure and has now become a permanent measure. And, Andy, you talked about in the press release, you, AOPA, talked about in the press release, the economic impact on some of the general aviation airports in the area affected by the Air Defense Identification Zone. I wonder how much of what remains of general aviation activity in this area consists of people who have been hanging on waiting to see how this went, and now that it's been made permanent, will decide just to completely shut down or pull out or move elsewhere.
Well, we don't know exactly how many people that is. I do know that there has been a great deal of anxiety going all the way into animosity among the pilot community in Washington, D.C. And again, I think the big thing is that there really hasn't been a very good explanation by the security community as to what the AIDIS really does. I think I mentioned it before, but the flight restricted zone, the area that's 15 miles around the center of D.C., pilots can generally understand the security-sensitive nature of that, but with the AIDIS, it becomes a lot more difficult for them to understand. And that was one of the messages that we continually took to Congress, that we took to the Department of Homeland Security officials, we took to the White House, and then we've talked as well with the Department of Defense, who, of course, ultimately, you know, they're the ones that are in that tough spot, if you will, of having to make a decision on someone that is not complying with the regulation or the NOTAM.
Well, we talked a few minutes ago about the due process that seemed to be somewhat circumvented here. What recourse does AOPA or the pilot population or anyone in the public have when there are no public hearings and we can't say there was no solicitation of public input, but when this thing goes this way, is there anything we can do to try to turn it back, or do we just have to look forward and see how we can undo it now?
Well, I think you're right in saying we have to look ahead and see what steps we can do, what we can take now that they've actually issued it and that it would go into effect on February 17th of next year. What we're doing is, first of all, we're looking to see whether or not there is a legal recourse that the association could take. That's something that we really would use and, you know, kind of the last ditch effort, to stop it from going final as a rule. But that's something that we're researching. And then as we look ahead to a new administration, there may be a change in the attitude that the next administration has related to general aviation, and one that could possibly be more favorable to general aviation than what we've currently seen. But beyond that, there may also be things that occur in the air traffic control system that may allow the security people to get the kind of information that they're looking for right now that require the AIDIS procedures that would not be necessary under, let's say, ADS-B, where there's a unique transponder-like identification for each aircraft. So there are some things that we certainly can look at as we move ahead. The most immediate thing, as I mentioned, is saying, hey, do we have a legal recourse here, and is that possible? So we'll have to... We'll have an attorney look at that issue right now, and then based on what they find and the probability of success there, then we'll move ahead accordingly.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned ADS-B. This could provide an incentive in at least one region of the country for early equipage.
Yeah, and that kind of ironic, but that could very well be the case, because it might be. A lot to be said here, but the one thing that is, I guess, if you want to say, I'm not even sure I could even classify this as a silver lining, but the one thing about being a rule is that rules can be amended, and they can be changed in the future, as again technology changes or just the overall attitude of the administration, whichever one it is, is the one making decisions about government policy.
Well, I think that there are a number of different corners of society where some things that have happened during the last 8 years that were based on being precautions against the war on, you know, as part of the war on terror are, you know, there are a lot of people, I think, who are kind of tired of some of them that seem a little onerous, and maybe that there will be a an overarching look at all of them to turn back some of these things. But in terms of specific actionable things that pilots can do, what does AOPA recommend for our community?
At this point, the one really, really important thing pilots can do is if they're flying within 60 miles of the Washington, D.C. ATIS, they have to comply with a training requirement, which also went into effect earlier this year, because that is fully implemented in early February. It's a simple training to go through, but they have to do it. Because, and the reason that I mention that is that violations are ultimately what really hurt the case we were trying to make, because we would go in and make the argument to policymakers, whether this was in Capitol Hill or whether it was in the White House or one of the agencies, we would go in and make the argument that, you know, the ATIS is unnecessary, it's putting a burden on the community, and then they would point to, yeah, but we have these violations of people not complying with these requirements, and, you know, we've got some serious questions about the community. Mm-hmm. And so, as odd as it sounds, actually complying and adhering to some of the rules that are out there is actually one of the best things that can happen for those that are in the area. Otherwise, I think that it's going to be really important for any security proposals that are out there. I use the large aircraft security proposal as an illustration, that are rule makings and not issues like what we found in the Washington, D.C. area,
right,
where pilots can actually have an influence on the outcome. They need to make sure their voices are heard, because people in the policy-making security apparatus, they need to understand that general aviation pilots are committed to fight terrorism. That's why Airport Watch is so helpful. But they also have some concerns about what's going to happen to them under some of these security proposals. So that's probably the most important thing I can ask of the pilot community.
All right. Now, the training in order to fly within 60 miles is available online. Is that at the AOPA site or the Air Safety Foundation site?
It's actually you have to, the FAA has set it up where you actually have to go to their website. We certainly have information on our website that'll link you right there. So that's a real easy way to get there. But the FAA, in making their decisions about how they were going to approach the training, they've kept it all inside the agency, and they are the ones that are actually providing the training itself via the web.
All right. Well, we will direct our listeners to look for that if they're anywhere in the area. And I guess, you know, if you have reason to think you may in the next, you know, in the coming year, in 2009, fly there, take the training anyway. It can never hurt to know more about the air traffic control system. And in this case, I mean, who knows? Maybe you'll wind up hitching a ride to AOPA Expo and get to fly some neat plane, and you want to make sure that that you're prepared for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have to say, Paul, just in closing here, there's no doubt that when I look at some of the issues that I've faced in my nearly 28-year career in advocating for general aviation, this has certainly been one of the more frustrating. Mm-hmm. It really has been, because I feel like, you know, we really haven't been able to get the voice heard and to get the action taken that we really wanted to have happen. And it is definitely something that we have relayed the frustration of the pilot community to the people in the government. And that's why it's always important that pilots take the opportunity to weigh in when proposals are issued.
Well, Andy, as always, we appreciate your work. We really appreciate your staying in touch on this issue, and we hope to talk to you again. Hopefully have some happier news in 2009.
Look forward to that.
Andy Sabula is Executive Vice President of Government Affairs for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. You can find out more at aopa.org. And you can find the FAA's site at faa.gov. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.